It's Friday, May 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, authorities fear a bomb may have brought down Egyptian airliner. Egypt fights Islamic State in the Sinai.
She made it on the basis of hard work.
A new president is set to take office in Taiwan. And it's been a while since we've heard from Corrine Bailey Ray. She's back. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Search teams in the Mediterranean have located wreckage of the Egypt Air jet that crashed into the sea as it approached Cairo on a flight from Paris. Egypt says terrorism is a more likely cause of the disaster than technical failure, but no definitive information is yet available. The Airbus jet with 66 people on board disappeared from radar Thursday, moments after it entered Egyptian airspace on the four-hour flight from France. Edward Uranian is in Cairo for VOA and tells International Edition's Susan Yockey all that we know so far about the ill-fated passenger jet.
We know it left Paris late last evening and that it disappeared from radar in Greece about 3:27 local time. It was a flight that was approaching the Egyptian coastline. It was south of the Greek island of Karpathos, and it had probably about 45 minutes left before it was due to land.
Who was on board?
Egypt Air says that there were 30 Egyptians among the passengers, 15 Frenchmen, and one or two passengers from 10 different nations.
And have we heard from any of the families of the passengers?
Yes. Some of the passengers were interviewed by Egyptian journalists on their way to the terminal building where Egypt Air and hospital officials were due to meet them. Several of the older women were crying, and one of the men was very angry and snapped at the journalists. Clearly, those are only the Egyptian passengers, so I can't tell you what's been going in France on the French side. But general consternation, fairly somber mood in Egypt in general over the crash.
Is anything being done for the families? Are they being given any special attention?
Well, certainly they've been kept away from journalists, other than those who are walking into the building and not under the control of the Egypt Air officials. They have reportedly been receiving psychiatric counseling. Clearly, that's one of the practices after a plane crash. Other than that, it's not clear whether the government is going to give them compensation. That sometimes happens during acts of terror or mishaps, rail mishaps. So we still have to wait on that detail.
And speaking of the government, they have been quick to come out and make remarks about this incident.
Well, I think what the retired Egyptian officials have been trying to say in private is that they're worried that another air mishap is likely to further impact the tourism sector, which has already been negatively impacted by the crash of the Russian passenger jet over the Sinai last October, and of the hijacking of an Egypt Air domestic flight to Cyprus last March, in addition to two separate attacks on tourists in Luxor and Hurghada, which are major tourist destinations in addition to Sharm el-Sheikh.
Could you tell us a little bit about the tourist industry there and how it's been affected by these incidents?
Up until now, the Egyptian tourism ministry has been fighting back to try to get tourists from other countries, Arab countries, when tourism has been negatively affected from Europe, from Britain, from Russia. Russia has canceled flights to the Sinai, so has Britain. That hasn't affected Cairo Airport so far. Tourists are still coming to Cairo, still going to other areas like Luxor and Hurghada, as I mentioned earlier. The hotels here in Cairo seem to have a large turnout of Arab tourists, so I don't know in terms of the actual numbers, how badly the economic performance is being affected. But certainly, Egyptian tourism officials have been trying to fill the gap with Arab tourists.
Edward Uranian in Cairo, where Egypt's aviation minister said France would be responsible for any security lapse if terrorism is found to be the cause of the crash. He also offered the theory that terrorism looms larger than mechanical problems as a possible cause of the crash. We turn now to how people are reacting to this developing story online. Our social media reporter is G. Abby Lee. She joins me in the studio to give us the snippets. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
Very sad situation. Mm-hmm. So how do we keep posted on this news?
I'd recommend going straight to the source by looking up Egypt Air on Facebook and Twitter. On Facebook, it's posting official press releases, and the latest one confirms that the country's Foreign Affairs Ministry declared the missing aircraft's wreckage has been found near Karpathos Island in Greece. It shows that many of the top comments are from the Egyptian people. One of them wrote, he wishes news outlets wouldn't blame the country's planes and airport because he claims the fault lies with terrorists.
Well, they don't want this incident, obviously, to affect their mm-hmm. national image. Now, what about on Twitter?
It's also there, at Egypt Air. It's tweeting both in English and Arabic. And the latest one in English reads like this. The Egyptian investigation team, in cooperation with a Greek counterpart, are still searching for other remains of the missing plane.
Well, gee, was there any reaction from Washington to this tragedy?
Absolutely. The State Department was the first to tweet about it, sharing a video of Secretary of State John Kerry expressing his condolences. One of the three presidential contenders, Donald Trump, tweeted about it as well. The presumptive GOP nominee wrote, "Looks like yet another terrorist attack. Airplane departed from Paris. When will we get tough, smart, and vigilant? Great hate and sickness." Now, that tweet received more than twice the number of retweets he usually gets. It was shared almost 10,000 times and liked by nearly 24,000 people so far, and that number is going up really quickly. Many media outlets are also tweeting the breaking news, and a number of comments are comparing this incident to the Malaysian Air Flight 370, which, as you know, disappeared into thin air quite literally more than 2 years ago. Jim, back to you.
Well, thank you for the wrap-up, G, and you may tweet your questions and comments to @VOA_IE. That's the Twitter feed for International Edition, and you may also tag me and G on those tweets. We're @VOA Stevenson and @GAbbyLee. Here are some of the top stories that are trending right now in Asia and that we're following on International Edition. China demands U.S. halt recon flights along coast. China official leaves Hong Kong with assurances of autonomy. 11 civilians, Afghan general, killed by roadside bombs. Russia wades into South China Sea dispute with ASEAN Accord. China's Silk Road Initiative seen as game changer. There's expanded coverage of these stories and much more on the VOAnews.com website and also on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Egypt's military is carrying out operations against Islamic State fighters in the Sinai Peninsula. That, according to the top U.S. general, Joe Dunford. VOA's Kyler Babb has been crossing the Atlantic Ocean on a trip from Brussels, and she's now arrived at a naval base in Kings Bay, Georgia. She joins us with more on what the general has told her about Egypt's fight against Islamic State.
Well, he said that the Egyptians are taking the fight to the Islamic State in the Sinai right now. I was speaking to General Dunford over the Atlantic while we were traveling from Brussels, where he was at a NATO Chiefs of Defense meeting. And now we're back in the United States, where he'll be focusing on the nuclear threat and the submarines of the United States. But he wanted to let us know that the United States was aware of the Islamic State in the Sinai. They'd been following them very closely. He says that there are about in the high hundreds to maybe about 1,000 Islamic State fighters in the Sinai. He added that there was also a sizable Bedouin insurgency there that is actually cooperating with Islamic State fighters, which is adding to their numbers, he said. But he wanted to make it clear that he didn't have a lot of the details, but he had been told by the Egyptians that they were conducting an operation right now, today, in the Sinai against the Islamic State. He said that he was looking forward to finding out the results of these ongoing operations in the coming hours.
We also have a plane that has gone down, an Egypt Air flight that was en route from Paris to Cairo. I realize you've just landed, but have you heard anything about that from your vantage point?
Yes, I did happen to ask a spokesman for General Dunford, Captain Greg Hicks, and he said that the downing of this plane had nothing to do with the Egyptian operations that are underway against the Islamic State. But we all know that last year, the Islamic State claimed responsibility for a downing of the plane. And so we're trying to figure out what was happening with this downing. We have no confirmation yet that the Islamic State was involved. There is no relation between the Egyptian operations, like I said, and the downing. But time will tell, because there's still a lot of investigations that need to be done. There's a lot of different governments and a lot of different militaries that are involved in all of this, and we'll just have to wait and see.
News of Egypt's anti-ISIS operation in the Sinai is coming as both U.S. and NATO allies are talking about the possibility of some training and equipping fighters in neighboring Libya.
Yes, this is something that has just hit this week. Secretary Kerry was mentioning it on Monday. It came up during the NATO Chiefs of Defense meeting. The NATO seems to be under the impression that as long as the Libyan government wants NATO to help, they are happy to go in and train. The only problem is they're not exactly clear on who they need to train, because a lot of militias have yet to throw their support for the Government of National Accord. So General Dunford told me that he said that there would be, if there was a training mission, it would likely be led by the Italians, who have a vested interest in Libya. He said it would be limited in scope, but when he said limited in scope, he didn't mean a small number. He meant that it would be a finite timeline for this training and equipping, a finite capacity, and it had to be in coordination with the Government of National Accord once they identify the fighters that need to be trained and equipped.
I know, Carla, that you were at the NATO meeting. Tell me a little bit about the overall feel and what they're looking for going forward.
Well, as someone who's been to another NATO meeting like this, I can tell you it felt a lot more coordinated, and it felt that the governments of these different NATO states were more together than they were in the past. And Chairman Dunford, I asked him about this, and he says yes, that we were looking for a cohesive approach, and he said that he thought that this meeting was much more productive.
Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb from Kings Bay, Georgia, at the Naval Base there. Carla, thank you so much for giving us the latest and joining with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tsai Ing-wen of the independence-leaning Democratic Progressive Party is to be sworn into office as president of Taiwan later today after winning elections in a landslide in January, insisting she will maintain the status quo with China. She has not embraced the so-called 1992 consensus, in which Taiwan and the mainland agreed to a one-China principle. Her KMT rival party predecessor, Ma Ying-jeou, fostered closer economic ties with Beijing. Taiwan analyst Bill Sharp of the Taipei-based Institute on Taiwan History tells VOA's Victor Beatty that Tsai will become Taiwan's first female leader.
And unlike other women who have taken on presidencies or prime ministerships in Asia, they all had a family connection, a husband that had preceded them, or a father who blazed the trail for them. She made it on the basis of hard work.
Her policy position vis-a-vis China and the relationship that Taiwan has with China is going to be key. Any idea what her policy is going to be, what she might say on Friday?
I'm certain she's not going to embrace the 92 consensus in her inaugural speech. While she might acknowledge that a meeting took place in 1992 in a fairly indirect way, she's not going to embrace the 92 consensus, and because her supporters don't. And if she were to embrace the 92 consensus, her supporters would abandon her party and find another party.
Is her view the majority view in Taiwan?
I think the majority view in Taiwan could be what's called the Taiwan consensus. Basically, yes, we want to maintain the status quo. The status quo is to have a relationship with China, One that's based on mutual respect. Obviously, we enjoy the trade relationship, but we are very wary about our becoming too dependent on China. We don't want to be as economically dependent. She is not advocating independence. She did not run on that platform. She ran on a platform purely focused on economic development, to put energy and life back into Taiwan's domestic economy.
China, at the time of the inauguration, is staging large-scale joint war games featuring mock beach landing, helicopter assaults, tank battles along its east coast facing Taiwan. Is China sending a message?
I think this is a very foolish gesture on China's part. Because every time that China tries something like this, they try to intimidate Taiwan, the only result is a negative one for China. Actions like this will only increase Taiwan's sense of self-identity, which is growing as we speak, and will also make Taiwan all the more wary of dealing with China.
China has never renounced the use of force to take the island, which it considers to be a breakaway province. Bill Sharp says China's support for ratification of the Cross-Strait Service Trade Agreement in 2014 in the Taiwan legislature backfired, giving rise to the so-called Sunflower Movement, which scuttled the effort. The student-led protest, which briefly occupied the legislature, feared economic unification with the mainland. Sharp says Taiwan's new leader will not pursue independence because it is also opposed by the United States, and she needs good trade relations with both the United States and China to achieve her goal of greater economic growth. You can follow the inaugural activities and much more by visiting our website, voanews.com. Follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. And while you're online, why don't you go to Facebook? Like us at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. You know, it's already been 6 years since British singer Corinne Bailey Rae released her last album. Well, as International Edition's David Byrd tells us, Rae's new album, The Heart Speaks in Whispers, reflects her new outlook.
Corinne Bailey Rae says she thought about never releasing another album. Her first self-titled album came out 10 years ago and was full of bubbly pop tunes, including the Grammy-nominated Put Your Records On. But then her husband of 7 years, Jason Rae, died of an accidental overdose in the midst of recording her 2010 CD, The Sea. The British singer and musician says she had to do some soul-searching before deciding to go back into the studio.
And really, this record has been a kind of rediscovery for me, sort of myself and my instincts and my dreams and my own body and how it can move and how I feel when I travel and how I feel when I go into a jungle and how I feel when I go swimming in the ocean and all of those things. So I think it's really served as a reminder to me to stay sort of connected and stay true to your own dreams and desires and personality and instinct and memory and all those things.
The 37-year-old singer did find love again. She married her longtime friend and producer Steve Brown in 2013. Corinne says that she also benefited from playing with different musicians, including multiple Grammy winners Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter, In Between the Sea and her latest release.
And that's had a really big impact on me, I think, just in terms of thinking about freedom. You know, they're both people who are so exceptional at what they're doing, have worked so hard as well at what they do, that when they get on stage, they can just fly, they're just free. And that's Wayne Shorter's whole thing, is like, you know, you don't practice on stage. Once you're on stage, you just kind of completely sort of open yourself up. And I think that's been a big influence on the record, really.
Many of the tunes on The Heart Speaks in Whispers carry a message of hope. Her song, I've Been to the Moon, speaks about vulnerability and opening your heart to someone else.
And I was just kind of singing out these phrases, and I was singing out this song, you know, I've Been to the Moon, and I didn't really know what it meant at first, you know. So I think some of the writing has been hearing these phrases come in and having to kind of, like, unscramble them or find out really what I'm trying to say with that song. So that song just kind of ended up being a metaphor for, you know, when you really put yourself out for someone and you want them to do the same thing for you.
Corinne says she didn't start out to write songs about hope. They just emerged organically as the album progressed. Corinne Bailey Ray's album, The Heart Speaks in Whispers, is available now. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Been listening to International Edition. You can find us any time of the day or night at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook, VOA Now is the place to go. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. For Tracy Carter, our director, Carl Starling, our engineer, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us, and we hope you have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Japan are leaders in the global digital economy, not just as producers and consumers, but as advocates for policies that enable its existence and development. Our partnership is strong, said U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State and U.S. Coordinator for International Communications and Information Policy, Daniel Sepulveda. Because we both believe that promoting continued global connectivity holds the potential to help lift people out of poverty, formalize the informal economy around the world, increase the efficiency of supply chains, increase the productivity of workers, raise wages, and improve people's lives. At the recent G7 Information and Communications Technology Ministers meeting in Japan, a new charter for the digitally connected world was agreed to. The Charter reaffirms fundamental principles, including promoting and protecting human rights, promoting and protecting the free flow of information, supporting the multi-stakeholder approach to internet governance, and strengthening digital connectivity and supporting inclusiveness for all. The Global Connect Initiative, launched by the U.S. last fall, is a large-scale effort to increase internet access around the world. The U.S. intends to partner with interested countries, including Japan, to develop strategies to spur connectivity and entrepreneurship, cross-border information flows, and open and competitive marketplaces. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, of which Japan is a part, will play a supporting role in the shared goals of strengthening the global internet. The internet represents the digital shipping lane for 21st century goods and services, and as such, the pending agreements with nations in the Pacific community will establish rules for the preservation of those virtual shipping lanes as means of conveying services and ideas, allowing startups and everyday people to challenge incumbent power in marketplaces and ideas. The United States and Japan share a common vision for the future of the global digital economy by expanding connectivity, keeping digital trade routes open, and creating policy environments that sustain growth and foster innovation. These are valuable long-term efforts, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Sepulveda, and we have the strong bonds as friends and allies that will help us succeed.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.